Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Blister Podcast on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. Today, Cody Townsend and I are back to review the news and to discuss all this talk about the end of the 50. So yeah, you're going to get a bit more clarity today from Cody himself on what exactly is going on here. And in addition to that, we're going to be talking about athlete boycotts and cartoons and parking lots and uproars and a whole lot more. This is another good one for you, folks. Oh, but I should say, we didn't have any Mountain Town advice questions this time. And as you know, we particularly like the Mountain Town relationship advice questions. So that's probably on us. We need to actually send out reminders in our newsletter ahead of time to give y'all some time to write in with those questions. But, you know, I'm doing it right now. Send us your Mountain Town advice questions or your Mountain Town relationship advice questions. You can send those in via email at info@blisterreview.com. You can send us a DM on our Blister Instagram account. You know, you got your ways. You know how to do this, folks. You know how the world works. But yeah, if you've got questions, we have some, well, probably pretty sketchy answers for you. So send them in. This episode of Reviewing the News is presented by Vertical Playground, which is our Blister-recommended shop in Oppdal, Norway. You can listen to our recent Gear 30 episode, that's number 289, with the founder, Trygva, to learn all about VPG's expertise and how they truly were pioneers in the arena of backcountry gear. VPG has been doing it for over 2 decades. They are dedicated to specialty service, and they offer everything from boot fitting to ski services, and they have an impressive skiing and backcountry gear selection, as well as an impressive selection of kayaking, mountain biking, and climbing gear. Vertical Playground offers a unique and curated shopping experience year-round for those who truly love the mountains. Furthermore, you should be sure to check out their online outlet store at vpg.no, and don't miss the latest updates from Trygva, including his work on the Forefront concept ski with Hoji. So yeah, check out VPG in Oppdal, Norway. Tell them we sent you, and you can always find them online at vpg.no. And now, let's review the news, shall we? Here we go. Well, Cody, we're back. I've actually left you alone. We haven't talked that much since the Blister Summit and our last reviewing the news. I was like, we were talking a whole lot. And I was like, what? Well, one, I think we both kind of had broken down physically a decent amount. But otherwise, other than that, I was like, well, you know, I'm going to give this guy a break. I don't want him to be, you know, Ellsworth out or anything. And so I'm happy to see you today and happy to be catching up here.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back. I think, did we end up taking like kind of March off? I don't know. I don't really remember. Or was it like the Blister Summit kind of counted for that? Because I was getting some comments on Instagram like, when in the F are you going to review the news? So.
Yeah. Yeah, we rolled out kind of the rare mid-month. So we kind of did mid-February. There was just a lot of different things going on. So I was like, we're not going to do another one 2 weeks later. So we opted for the longer break than the shorter break. But, you know, it's nice to know that the people were maybe missing us a little bit.
Yeah, no, it is nice. I mean, sometimes I'm like, why are we doing this? We're just a bunch of dudes talking about the news, but I guess people like to listen, which is awesome. I think even that little bit of extra time, I think we got some like pretty good news stories. You know, the more time we have, the more interesting news stories comes out, and got a bevy of interesting ones today. And then I'm going to be gone for 3 months, so you know, everyone, you might need to find some fill-ins.
Okay, so this is actually the thing I've been wondering about, because you said this, you're like, I'm going to be out for 3 months. But you know what I'm going to do? I'm definitely going back to ask Len to come in and do the Len Nessifer. And then you're going to start getting like FOMO. And then I feel like I'm going to get a text from you that's like, hey, actually, you know, plans got switched up because of weather or blah-bitty blah. And so I'm like standing on some other peak. And like, if I hold up a hot spot a certain way, I can still call in and record a reviewing the news. Because I feel like you're going to get some FOMO because Len's going to come in. Len doesn't know that I'm going to ask him again. So, you know, if he listens to this, then hi, Len. But I think that's what's going to happen. And I think your FOMO, I'm going to get a text. That's what I predict.
I don't know if it's actually FOMO. Like maybe it's FOMO from like 35 years ago because I look, if I listen to him talk, I'm like, damn, you're so much smarter and more articulate and thoughtful than I am. So it's more that, like, I should have got like more school instead of being this like skier dude. So maybe that's the only FOMO I'll get because I mean, personally, I love listening to Len. And I feel like it's a worthy replacement. In fact, it's probably a better replacement than what I bring. So I'll be excited to listen to those when I get back because I don't know where I'm going to be. I don't think I'll be able to text. So,
okay. How much or how little would you like to share about what you'll be up to over the next 3 months?
Just going to Alaska for 3 months. Got a couple of expeditions kind of back to back and then some skiing and some projects kind of around Girdwood in the Chugach area with Elise and some other kind of local Alaskan friends and whatnot. So that's the main gist of it. But back to back expeditions starting April 25th and going all the way to June 21st. So going to be out in the wild for a while. It's one of these interesting things. Like I see already, I don't know, social media, whether it's from resorts or friends or whatever, and they're talking about winding down the season and whatnot. We're getting to the end of it. I mean, hell, Crescent Butte's what, closing in like a week or so?
Yeah.
And my life that I've set up with my true season doesn't start till April 25th. And it's kind of interesting. It's like why I try and pace myself in the beginning of the season, knowing that like when everyone's like lounging in the sun and going to lakes, we'll be at higher altitudes and camping on glaciers and freezing our ass off. So yeah.
Speaking of expeditions and lines and the like, I think I want to start off for news with this announcement of yours that received quite a response and quite a lot of attention. I guess it was sort of called the end of the 50. Let me just have you take it from there. This was kind of the, I don't know, it seemed a little bit clickbaity to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not above clickbait.
No. I'm smart enough to know marketing strategy. Okay. But ultimately, there's a few reasons why I wanted an actual say, like, this is the end of the 50, because it is the end of the 50 as it's known, as a web-based YouTube series of multiple episodes, you know, maybe one longer movie per year, but it's just this like web series that's been consistently coming out for 5 years. You know, the first year was like 25 episodes, and we've kind of tailed off. Had a pandemic in the middle of it. But as we got less and less lines, you know, it wasn't coming as consistently. So that, as we know it, is done. The rest of the lines, the last four lines, as I say in the episode about Bloody Kular, I'm going to keep trying those. But the format in which it comes out, when it comes out, all that is yet to be determined. What I really wanted to do is create a bookend for what has been going on for 5 years with this series. So there's two things that can happen. One, I can kind of work on the 50 in the background, work on these lines without the pressure of necessarily making episodes out of it. You know, there's a chance that it's just like, this line is in and Bjarne are going to go there tomorrow and just try and document the minimum amount that we can of it, as opposed to what takes a lot of time is crafting these stories, doing setup, being in that zone for a while. So I won't have necessarily that pressure of making these episodes. At the same time, it allows for new things on YouTube. And this is, you know, there's going to be a break. So I would rather be like over informative than just kind of like the 50 fades away and maybe there's these other episodes or lines or ideas or stories that are starting to come out and people are going like, what happened to the 50? What happened to that? And so, you know, not knowing when these lines are going to be completed or even attempted, like it could be 2 more years, it could be 7 more years, 10 more years. I don't know that. So I wanted to put this like ending point and like moving forward, what comes out on YouTube is probably going to be something quite different. I mean, different in the way that it's not the 50, but probably still centered around ski touring, adventuring, other sorts of stuff in the mountains. But that's the reason why. And I was trying to be really articulate about that, which is really hard to explain to, you know, hundreds of thousands of viewers.
It was pretty cool to see on the most recent episode the many, many, many number of people writing in and just saying like how much the series has meant to them. I was actually a little surprised by your response to that, where you did seem a bit surprised yourself. You know, this is actually something, you know, we did our first Blister Awards at our last Blister Summit. And for best ski film, we awarded The Polar Star. And I talked about this a bit, and we have yet to roll out some of this footage, but I felt a little bit justified by the many comments from other viewers of the 50, sort of the way that I sort of said something like, you know, The Polar Star was a great film and I really love it, but I do think it does, it's the award, and part of the reason we gave that film the award was that it did kind of stand in for the series itself. And I was like, man, I sure hope we aren't the only ones who kind of felt this way. And if people want to go look at the comments that came in on the most recent episode, you'll see that it wasn't just us, I guess we can say.
Totally. No, it was honestly like when we did the episode and I was working through it, and the reason it took so long to come out was getting that archival footage, that 20-year-old footage of the first time I skied it when I was about 19 years old, 18 years old. It took like 8 months to figure out how to get that. Ended up having to ship it off to a pretty high-end service to get it pulled, and it ended up working. But like when we crafted it and I watched the first time through, added that voiceover at the end, and I watched it with Elise for the first time, and I kind of got a little choked up, both of us. And then when the comments started coming in and people started kind of sharing their stories of watching this, and like, you know, their family being brought together to watch this, you know, they moved out west and started ski touring because of it. They're in their 50s, 60s, and 70s and went on their first like backcountry ski day ever because of it. It was like, honestly, it was really powerful. And like, I know I've seen those comments before, but it was such an outpouring of support that like I like was straight up like crying at one point, which was like crazy just to feel, I don't know, this like what this series has meant to someone. It like gave it to me like some sort of purpose, because like, you know, I've talked about it here, but I like sometimes you struggle, or I struggle as a pro skier, being like, what am I actually doing? What am I doing for this planet? What is the meaning of my job? Because at times it feels like such a selfish pursuit, and a selfish pursuit of my own goals and adventures and happiness and joy and whatnot. And when I read how it's changed people's lives for the better, it's like, oh, okay, well then this has had some purpose to it. And I think it's what really got me choked up, and just like the totality of your career kind of coming to this point. And it was, yeah, I was kind of overwhelmed with how much love and support there was. So yeah, just thinking about it still almost kind of like chokes me up a little bit, just because it was like so powerful.
So these next 3 months, you'll be out and about in the mountains, but maybe with less clear deadlines for filming and the like. Is that true? Or do you think you'll be doing just as much documentation over these next 3 months as has kind of been integral to what you've been up to for the last several years?
Since we've had a lot of time to plan these expeditions and you kind of just have to go into them, it's going to be very similar. It's just kind of opening, like I said, there's that chance that like one line comes in and I don't know, Bjarne's not available. I would do everything in my power to make sure he's there, but it's like, you know, I might just go do it and bring a GoPro and that's it. So it's just more the kind of taking this a little bit of the pressure away from producing and focusing on just these lines, because I truly like the last four lines are incredibly challenging. You know, the Comstock feels like the easiest one, but that's been a total thorn in my side. I just keep kind of mistiming it, and you know, trying to read the weather and the snow conditions from 1,000 miles away is really difficult. So you know, these lines are really, really difficult, and I want to kind of give them the space to just work on based upon my schedule, my fitness, family life, not as much as like, hey, your career is tied into producing an episode about this thing. So I want to kind of remove that a little bit. And then, yeah, allow for more freedom in telling some other stories. So, but yeah, the next 3 months I'm really looking forward to. That's kind of what I've been training for the last 9 months for, just very specifically for these back-to-back expeditions, and should be exciting. And you just feel like I'm as prepared as it gets, but you just need the weather and the snow conditions, and hopefully we can go have a grand adventure in the mountains.
Yeah. I hope you do.
Yeah.
Want to get on to some other news?
Yeah, let's get into reviewing the news.
So this is pretty fascinating. Crankworx, I imagine, I would have to think that many of our listeners would have at least seen this crop up, but there was effectively a writer's strike, I think we could call it, for the Crankworx men's slope style event taking place down in New Zealand. By the way, our bike guys at Blister, who, I don't even know if you know this yet, Cody, but we've just started spinning off on our Bikes and Big Ideas podcast, a monthly reviewing the news there, since we do tend to skew a bit more to the, not just ski and snowboard side of things, but you know, we don't always dive into all of the bike news out there, and turns out every month there's a lot of it. So over on our Bikes and Big Ideas podcast, I know that for that bike edition of Reviewing the News, they're going to be talking a lot more about this. But I wanted to touch on this with you because I think it has a lot of implications for just kind of comps and events in general. You want to try your hand at summing up what's going on here?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, it was like a quasi-union of the male slopestyle athletes had a list of very specific demands that included flat payments for appearance fees, increased awards fees, and other things related to like rider safety. Like they wanted the events to start before noon so that there was less chance of wind being present in the slopestyle contest and being to kind of forced to ride through what they seem to be as dangerous conditions. And they put a very, very specific kind of deadline date to it. They were like, Friday, March 22nd, if you do not meet our terms, they even said this is not a negotiation. If you don't meet our terms, we are all united walking out of this competition. As a spoiler alert, Crankworx did not meet their demands, and the contest, which is on the 24th, so it happened 2 days ago, did not have a men's slopestyle event because the riders walked out of it. You know, it's made some news because it's one of the first times I've ever seen a group united quite like this with very specific demands, a quasi-union and almost strike against a contest. And, you know, I mean, I'll say to start when we talk about it, like my first take and thought about this was like, you know, good on the riders, like using their collective power to kind of force their needs. And their needs aren't that difficult. They were talking about stuff of just like a $2,000 appearance fee, you know, just to potentially cover some of the costs that it takes to go to New Zealand for the Rotura event. And then the safety stuff, it makes a lot of sense. But as I've kind of dove deeper into this and thought about this more, I do think there's a little bit more complexity to it. I don't know what your first initial reaction was.
I first was unclear how much runway, how much advance warning was given to the organizers of Crankworx about this, right? So when I first heard about it, it sounded like this was a bit more of a gotcha thing, right? That maybe some things they'd said, we want to see these changes, whatever, but that it had not been clearly communicated. You know, if we don't have these things met at this time, you know, so I thought there was more of a gotcha component than maybe is actually true.
Yeah, because I read a few things that was talking about they've been kind of making these basic demands for years and have made no progress on them. So I do think there was a bit of built up tension. I would like to think that these athletes are smart enough not to be playing games quite that heavy of to like show up to an event and then make these demands. And they're like, we are not financially prepared for this. Maybe there's a tiny bit of that, but it sounds like this has been ongoing for many years from some of the stuff I've read a little bit deeper into it.
And so let me say this, my take on this, I would be far more on the side of the riders if in fact the like, and I know these facts are out there, I just don't have them yet, but if they had made clear months in advance, here's where we are, this is what we're asking for, if we don't receive these things, we will not be participating. To that, I say 100%. Everybody has the right, you know, to say this is what we need to feel good about competing. And if Crankworx, again, if it was the case that Crankworx was like, we kind of think you're bluffing, so we're just going to kind of move this thing forward and assume that you will, you know, ultimately yield and still show up and compete, to me, that makes it very easy to be on the side of the riders here, right? I'm going to leave it at that. Do you agree with that or...
Yeah, I mean, if they are been ongoing demands, and I'll give the riders the benefit of the doubt that this wasn't totally completely sprung on them. The thing I've thought about is just the counter argument is that I've long thought about like, hey, how could pro athletes in our realm unionize or unite a little bit to advocate for some of the things? Like, there's things. You know, most professional athletes, their title sponsors, there are injury clauses with buried within them. It's something I've fought against for years, but you almost have no power to when it's just yourself fighting against them. And these injury clauses are being that like, hey, if you have a career ending injury or not even a career ending, a season ending injury, they can dock your pay and pay you up until, you know, the day you got injured, which is completely counter against what other clauses within contracts that are saying we're paying you because you're one of the top athletes in the world. We need you to be an athlete, et cetera. So they're like, on one side, push it, progress the sport, be a top athlete. But also, if you get hurt, we're going to cut your pay, which is just so, it's like brutal as an independent contractor who is kind of always kind of negotiating contracts year to year. You know, we have such little job security. So I've thought about like, hey, how do we unionize or how do we unite? One thing that's, you know, we've seen and talked about it here is like knowing other people's salaries. Most people within the industry, we have these clauses in our contracts that are not allowed to share what we make. Meanwhile, all other pro sports, like literally there's lists of what everyone makes. So you can be like, hey, this guy's batting 298, I'm batting 303. He's making 10 more million dollars than me. I want 10 more million dollars. So that, you know, could we do that? So I liked this when I first saw it. I was like, hey, these guys are unionizing. But my one thing is like, maybe this wasn't the right target because I don't know the size of Crankworx. I don't think it's like more than a couple million dollar company, you know, in terms of like, I don't think they're necessarily like, they're not on the level of the bike companies. They're not $100 million companies up to $1 billion companies, companies that most of us deal with. And so I can see in some of the press releases that Crankworx released and some of the comments, and then even a kind of a thread from one of the old Crankworx owners saying like, this guy's like, you're going to bankrupt us. Like, this is brutal. Like, we were not financially prepared for this. We are not this massive organization. We are not this international conglomeration that is like driving profit only. We are a bike event. We are rooted within this culture. So to me, it was like, maybe the target wasn't the exact thing. Like, maybe the spirit is good, but maybe it had to be spread a little wider, so more of a bike industry. There's a lot of complexity, though, and it's one of the reasons I've always thought, I'm like, man, doing a skiers union or something like that would be really difficult. Plus, like, from the public don't look at us and empathize anything with us. They're like, whatever, you guys are spoiled brats and get to ski for a living, you know? So that's also, you kind of need that public will behind you. And so I found there's obviously a lot of debate on this crankwork stuff, and it's pretty, from what I've seen, just at least online, which is not a good measure, but it's like pretty 50-50, being like, you know, people calling them like, yeah, holding crankworks hostage. And at the same time, there is a lot of support for it. So I don't know. I'm like, I'm proud that they did it, but I don't know if it was the right target. That's my main takeaway from it.
Yeah, and I think we will say once again, you and I do not possess all of the details, all of the facts of these, the negotiations and the rest. What I like about raising it here is, again, rather than simply sitting here for us to adjudicate who was right and who was wrong in this particular instance, I like that we're putting this forward to think about, again, just how competitions and events work in general. In, let's call it, the broader mountain sports. And, you know, I think, let's say you're right, without knowing the financials of Crankworks, it is a business. If these things are going to be put on, you know, year in and year out, it does require a lot of resources, time, energy, capital, etc. And, you know, I think the one thing that I would hope is happening with whatever the negotiations are here, is that, yeah, I would like to see all athletes taken better care of. You know, I think a lot about the fact that, I mean, hell, the FWT that just went down, right?
Jesus.
On, right?
Like, so sick.
Look, I'm willing to wager you $10,000, like, at the upcoming NBA finals, no basketball player is going to risk their life in those finals. Whereas you watch what went down on the Bechter Ross, I'm like, that is heavy, totally. Right? And so we think a lot about the outsized paychecks, right, that NBA athletes are getting to play a game where they are absolutely not risking their lives versus the compensation for the top skiers and snowboarders in the world to get on stuff that is mind-boggling and terrifying, right? So what needs to happen here? And I sure hope that in these negotiations, like, there is a partnership here. So it's fair, I think, for athletes to be like, hey, we're really risking life and limb, compensate us better. And then if the, you know, the various event organizers, if they're like, okay, well, then help us promote the event more, right? And I do think athletes can do that. And we're talking in generalizations here for all events, but I don't think it's enough for athletes to just show up to these things, right? If they want to start like helping with sort of some of the chicken and egg stuff here, how do we get more revenue to better compensate athletes? Well, I sure hope that there are, you know, interesting and reasonable things that could be done just in terms of helping to promote these events. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it brings the FWT comparison is kind of why I brought up the comparison to maybe this isn't the right target, because like I was involved from the Free Ride World Tour from the very beginning. It was the very first year. I was on the first 3 years of a tour. Friends with Nicholas Hale Woods, who runs it, and they've always struggled. They've barely survived for years. They've run in deficits in certain years. Getting title sponsors is really tough. It's a really, really tough game for them. And so I think about, like, what if, like, the men or the women on the Bechter Ross all of a sudden had this big strike, their premier event, and you're just like, man, like, you might just end the most premier thing, one of the coolest things going on in skiing right now because of that. I also know that the Free Ride World Tour has done a lot to make sure that the athletes are heavily involved in safety discussions, heavily involved in prize money discussions. There's actually a pro athlete board, one I was a member of. You have to be competing on it and be like you're part of a board and literally you are part of the team that says, are we going tomorrow? Are we not going tomorrow? So there's athlete representatives that get to say like, no, we're not going tomorrow. We feel it's unsafe. I don't know if Crankworx does that. We don't know all the details of it, but I know it's been successful for the Free Ride World Tour. When it comes down to the risk equation, like I try to hem and away from that essentially because like, it's up to the individual that wants to take that risk. And should they be paid more? Yeah, I think so, because it's an incredible show and they're some of the most talented athletes in the world. But ultimately, like the market kind of dictates it. And so it's unfortunate that, you know, Marcus Grogan, who did one of the sickest new lines ever done on the Bec de Ross, isn't making more than €10,000 check for that. You know, probably what a basketball player makes in like 3 dribbles in the finals. But ultimately, like that's who Marcus is. He's going to be doing that stuff. But I just go back to the like, I feel like if this action was done to the Free Ride World Tour, the Free Ride World Tour would cease to exist. And I feel like there's quite a lot of threat that the industry as a whole to get rid of a big event because you could financially jeopardize them. I think the target is more the industries, the how they're paying it, because I've just seen pay continually get reduced over the years. You know, like when I first started out, it was the golden age of free skiing. The contract values were high, but like, you know, my first contract ever with Salomon was $6,000. I was nobody, and I thought that was a ton of money. Now, majority of athletes that are just starting out with a company and was in that same position that I am, $0, and $0 for many, many, many years. It is really, really hard to make money. And so, like, I've done in my whole career of trying to prove the value that athletes bring to these brands, but, like, you're like, invest in this and I guarantee it'll come back in droves. But as they have the power to continually just lower and pay. And so I would almost, in a certain way, it's like, hey, can Crankworx and these athletes come together to work with the brands to increase these pays, to increase travel budgets, to make these things better for these guys, more financially viable? That's a route I would have taken, but I'm like, overall, I like the spirit of it, of these athletes coming together to fight for basic needs, including safety. So I don't know. It's an interesting one. I definitely am curious to hear, because this all happened like this weekend, more details as they come out. I know it's just currently a really hot topic.
Before we move off this, I want to give you kind of one more chance to see if you currently have, if you were, you know, the sports czar, to take a line from Bill Simmons. You just said you would like to see, or correct me if I got it wrong here, you would like to see brands stepping in, mm-hmm, to better support athletes to then make it more viable for them to go compete in these individual events, rather than putting the onus on the event organizers themselves to raise that money to better compensate athletes for participating in particular events?
Yeah. I mean, because that's where majority of the money is. Putting on events is really, really difficult. It's really, really expensive. It's incredibly libelous. Like, there's a reason why the Free Ride World Tour doesn't happen in America. We don't have American events, and it all comes down to insurance. They're in, closest we get is Canada, and then the rest is in Europe, because the amount of the insurance costs that it takes to run these events is through the roof in America. So, those insurance costs could be covered when you've got billion-dollar companies that would want to support this. So, and I just continually, like, I've spent a lot of my career, and especially within the last 5 years, digging up as much data as I can to show the value that like I and other athletes are bringing to companies. And I just look at it as like, look, like you are a company and your main goal is to make money. I get that. We can help you do that. You just have to invest in the humans. I kind of went on the, you saw it, the like little threads rant about like seeing more and more money being shifted into digital advertising. And my big thing is digital advertising is great. You get a lot of data from it. You can show like, hey, I put $1 in and I got $3 back. So let's keep doing that. Well, the thing is, you could do that at $10,000 and get $30,000 back. You could do that at $100,000 and get $300,000 back. But it doesn't work at $1 million. You don't all of a sudden get $3 million back. These things don't scale. Athletes build culture and they build community, and culture and community scales. There are companies out there that have built themselves into massive companies on the backs of iconic athletes. And I kind of went into that. Obviously, we all know Michael Jordan being the single biggest one, but even, you know, Kilian Jornet and Salomon, when it comes to running shoes, that was just a marriage made in heaven and has helped Salomon become one of the most premier trail running brands in the world. There's plenty of instances of that. And so I'm always trying to tell them, like, invest in this. Like, we don't actually cost that much. And there can be this like exponential scale of return that you get off of it. Plus, regardless, when we talk about it, and Len talked about it in that episode, like building community and building culture is so important to these sports. And that's what leaders of sport do. So to me, like I would be, if I was a sports bar, I'd be just putting together a massive deck of information of showing like why investing in humans is more is better than investing in digital advertising, why it's better than investing in, you know, just Instagram ads and stuff like that, or influencers at that. So, and a specific bad kind of influencers. That's a whole other topic we could talk about. We all have influence as athletes, but just saying that kind of specific product placement-y kind of influencer. So,
I think you would agree with this, but because you did just say a minute ago, like there's absolutely a place for digital marketing. But when we start seeing, and by the way, I hear these conversations too, when we're talking to companies, when we start seeing everybody just handing all their money over, their ad money over to Meta, you and I talked about this offline. That is when I want marketing directors listening to this right now. You are starting to lose that long-term credibility and richness of the brand itself, right? You don't get to build that brand and continue to grow a sort of robust brand by shoving all of your marketing budget into running digital ads on Facebook and Instagram. That's not how this works. And now we get back into like compensation and why a marketing director who's like, look, I'm on the hook. If I'm not growing short-term sales, they'll just can me. And now we're back into like how do revenue streams work, right? But for, let's say, CEOs of companies looking at this, you all better not fall in love just with that short term. So, you know, so you said like, you said at the very end, this is why I think it's better to invest in people than like digital advertising. I would say you probably need to be investing in both. And if you start falling into the temptation of just moving 80%, 90%, 95% or more of your ad spend to just running fucking Facebook ads and Instagram ads, I don't like your chances. I don't think you're going to have built a stronger brand in the next 5 to 10 years. Having moved away from actual individuals showing up, you know, showing, exhibiting that passion for the sport. I like truly believe that. That's not like some, like, I don't know, hippy dippy pie in the sky stuff. Like, I actually believe that. Like, it's bad business, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, you can compare this to other sports. And a big one and a hot topic, and I think we both listen to similar podcasts and whatnot, is basketball. And there's been a lot of hullabaloo about basketball viewership shrinking in the last few years, even as the league seems to be expanding. And one of the reasons they're saying is like stars are fading. The people, the players are not necessarily in their prime, like when LeBron and Steph Curry were in their prime and the sport was really growing. And so it goes back to this of being like, look, people are what build these things. And if you're not investing in people, then you're going to not build something that's long-term and sustainable. And that can weather, you know, down years, that can weather a reduction in digital advertising spend. And so to me, like, this all comes back to just, I've started to really think about in our very fractured world of like media and so many different sports and so many different things, and everyone's got, you know, so many different choices. And to me, like, the most powerful thing you can do is build culture and community. And when you build a culture and you build a community, people are gravitated towards that and are going to buy in. And it's not a thing to, I think, to exploit for marketing purposes. I think it's just you build something that is powerful that people want to be a part of. We've talked about it here about like one of the things that I've personally harped on Vail was like destroying kind of marketing individual ski resorts as being something cool, and watch, you know, employing people that want to come to Whistler because Whistler's the coolest place on the planet and I'll work for pennies just so I can be there. That marketing evaporated and now it's just the Epic Pass. Well, people don't necessarily want to go work for pennies and sleep on a cot in a closet to go work for the Epic Pass. They want to do there because they want to be a part of something cool and build the culture and community around it. And that's just, I mean, that's what I guess coming back to this whole entire thing goes back to, like, the ultimate thing is I feel like we keep forgetting that people are the most important thing. People are the thing you invest in and people are the thing that are going to end up buying. So, like, invest in that, not necessarily in algorithms.
Want to talk about parking lots?
Oh, yeah. This was one of the more fun stories I think I've read this year.
Yeah, you go with this. You loved this one. I read it and found myself actually mostly thinking, this is actually really complex to me.
Super.
Yeah, you told me that you love this, so you take it from here.
This is from the Jackson Hole News and Guide, and the headline is Lyft Lines, comic causes kerfuffle after exposing JHMR, so Jackson Hole Mountain Resort parking hack. Joking a lot about lot access, cartoon reveals worker indignation, economic tension. So Lyft Lines is a comic. We've probably seen it shared on Instagram. That's a local to the Jackson area that does a comic for the Jackson Hole News and Guide. And I can't quite explain the comic. You're probably just going to have to click the link and look at it. But there was a kind of an allusion to this free parking hack at Jackson Hole Resort. And it was this underground kind of myth, a little bit of knowledge, where people could go into the paid parking area, get a ticket, do something with their phone, the services that that deals with the payment system, do something with that. And then all of a sudden they could park in what was a lot that would be like $35 a day for free. And so a lot of resort workers specifically were finding out about this hack and using it for kind of years to go drive into the resort and park in paid parking for free. You know, free parking at the resort hack is the biggest part of this comic. It doesn't give up what the hack is, but it definitely says like there's some sort of hack out there. And it caused an absolute like nuclear explosion of vitriol and, like the headline says, economic tension and worker indignation about this parking hack. So I don't know what I want to hear your take after you read it. And then I'll kind of go into some of what things stood out to me.
Yeah, I found myself the as I kept reading and getting more information from this article, I kept like changing my opinion for sort of who was in the right and who was in the wrong on this. Because basically, in a way to me, this article frames things up in such a way that I found myself thinking, like, was the cartoonist right in sort of exposing this hack, or was he wrong for doing that, right? That's how it, like, are the workers in the wrong here for being angry, or is the cartoonist in the wrong here for having exposed it? And I gotta say, the cartoonist is absolutely unapologetic. He's like, I don't apologize for anything here, you know, and I found myself thinking, like, dude, again, if you actually live in one of these small towns, it's really not very cool. Like, I thought that attitude, that doesn't seem like how you operate, like, among the actual locals in a town such as, you know, Jackson and Teton Village. And yet, there was the part about when we got to the part where it said that, look, there is a free bus that JHMR workers, it is available to them, they are supposed to be taking. That made me think a little bit, like, why aren't we utilizing the free bus here? Seems like that, you know, should be something that, like, we could get behind and support. So, at the end of the day, with what I know so far about this, I still found it kind of uncool that the cartoonist is like, I apologize for nothing. I don't think that's the right... I don't think that... That dude is, didn't just get more popular in his own town, I don't think.
No. He talks about locking his doors at his house for the first time in 6 years and lots of threats coming in. I think he made himself public enemy number one for a pretty short period of time in this town. So,
and then to you, like, is that kind of understandable? Or are you on the side, like, absolutely, people should absolutely not have that kind of take toward this guy? Because I kind of get it.
So here's my take in general. I don't think he was right, and I don't think he was wrong. I think he's a comic. And that's, like, to me, like, comedians, people in these that have these things, I think that's what they're supposed to do. Point at, make fun of, sometimes make you think about things in life. So to me, like, I don't think he bears any necessarily responsibility for it. I think, like, he's been a catalyst to flare up tensions that were already there. You know, I personally think, like, that's a role within society. I think if you know, when people get pissed off at comedians, there's comedians that can overstep and just be completely stupid and ignorant. And you're just like, no, you're just trying to get laughs for being really opinionated and kind of just divisive or whatnot. But then there's those comedians that I think are incredible that can say things in such a way that, like, feels like it hits you right in the heart and right at who you are, but makes you think about it, makes you truly, like, okay, like, what are my own positions at this? I think that's what defines some of the best comedians of our generation and our time. And so I'm not going to compare this cartoonist to that, but I do think as a role, I think it's totally fine to absolutely out this. And because, like, all of a sudden it creates tension. It didn't create tension. It showed tension that's already there. So in a certain way, like, I'm not trying to say, like, he was right and or wrong, because I don't, like, if he knew about this, he's never supposed to talk about it. And is it going to be more and more people that start finding out about this hack? And then soon the lot is going to be filled up with people that aren't paying and everyone's driving their cars and there's traffic and there's, like, we're just back to square one. Like, ultimately, like, eventually someone is going to find out about it and the resort is going to fix this hack. They fixed this hack after this comic came out and tensions boiled because of it. But I think it was coming out no matter what at some point. And it was probably to a point when too many people were using it. Now, I'm on the side of the workers in general. I do think this issue is symptomatic of just mountain town living in general, and especially is of Jackson Hole, being that it's one of the, you know, it is the richest county in North America, in America, and it is also one of the most expensive places to live. And if you're working at a resort, you may not making that much money. So, like, these tensions are just there underlying. So to me, it's like, yeah, like, I don't like the system where people that can afford to pay $35 a day should be able to drive their cars and park wherever they want. I feel like if you want to reduce traffic, you make everyone get on a bus. If that's the case, I don't care if you're a billionaire, you're getting on the bus. I don't care if you're a worker, you're getting on the bus. That's the only option. So I don't know. Like, I kind of look at it as like, no, he just pointed out something that was going on in their town.
Okay. First of all, with respect to comics, I definitely agree with you. Let's just use Dave Chappelle as an example,
yeah.
Right?
Who's a
controversial
good example.
Figure. Yeah, controversial very. Figure. I think that we absolutely need, in all of our countries, across society broadly, we have to have the old role of the court jester, right? That character that can absolutely fire off at the authorities, you know, unapologetically, fearlessly, and say whatever they have to say, and they do not come under fire for that. Right? Like, they almost get these medallions. I think of, like, frankly, Charles Barkley has kind of achieved that sort of status. You do not have to agree with a Dave Chappelle or Charles Barkley on every single thing they say, but I am glad that those two are out there firing, right? And that's how you rethink things. You don't just fall into the status quo, etc. Now, this dude is not Charles Barkley or Dave Chappelle. And the other thing, the huge disconnect here, is this is not how mountain towns operate, right? You already alluded to it, but in reading this article, one of the like low key, when people are always like, oh, you know, they listen to these things or different podcasts we do, and they kind of get their mountain town fix a little bit, you know, people who live in bigger cities. That low key statement about I locked my doors for the first time in 6 years, it's like, that's what it is to live in a mountain town, right? And to like roll out a hack that then blows that for your fellow workers in a town, I'm not saying, that's why like I just don't, that's where the analogy breaks down for me between a Dave Chappelle or something, right? So I would say like, you can sit there and say, I don't apologize for any of this, but I'd also say then you don't understand what it actually means to participate in the day in, day out of some of the things that are weird or particular about these small communities that we live in. That's my take on that.
Yeah, I guess my thing is that you're asking him to choose a side. Choose the workers, the working class that you're a part of, or the corporation, the rich people that get to pay. And like, it seems like, well, stand in solidarity for sure with the working class and with yourself. But like, that's where I'm saying, like, he doesn't involve himself in either of those. You're outside of those structures as a comic, looking at it and pointing things out and generally trying to get a laugh out of it. So yes, like maybe this wasn't the best thing to do in a small mountain town because he is getting threats, because it is a small mountain town. But I also, to me, it's like he's outside of it. And if I look at it as like, this would have come out at some point and this would have made news. It came out through a comic and it's boiled up a lot of tensions within the town because of it. So I'm like, I just look at the comic as like you're saying, a court jester. It's just, it's almost like removed. They're like part of the royals, but they're also not. They're like part of the working class, but they're also not. And it's just like they're removed from society, looking at it and trying to make fun of it. And so that's where I'm just trying to think, like, I'm like, I don't fault him for it. Even though like, yeah, like I do, like, it's kind of a bummer. That these workers at the resort don't get to drive their car up and park so as close and be there, you know, paying $0 to go park near where they work. But at the same time, like, I think it's just like, this is what happens and it was going to happen at some point.
Hmm. Here's one last thing I'll say on this, because back to that whole, you know, JHMR employees are told take the free bus. I would love to have some JHMR workers write us and tell us, like, actually the bus system is fantastic, or it actually doesn't work very well. Or, you know, if people on the ground there are like, yeah, people would use that free lot, but people actually were kind of like, an emergency came up, I missed the bus, I had to drive. I would love to know a little bit more from people on the ground there, how that system sort of actually worked, Or if it was just people, it's like, the bus is super convenient. I just don't want to take it, right? Maybe that sways my opinion a little bit.
It's been a long time since I spent a lot of time in Jackson. But when I was, and I was filming with TGR, it was like 10 plus years ago, and I was there for the years that they switched from free parking to paid parking and carpool stuff and whatnot. And I remember feeling as a young guy, a skier, and who's used to just driving in your car, parking in the lot, and going, using your car as a base camp and going skiing, I was like, wow, this is super greedy, and I can't believe they're doing this. And my friend's house that I was staying at, crashing at, they're pretty close to the Wilson lot, and I remember quickly learning you just go park in the Wilson lot, and then the bus was there like every 10 minutes. It was so convenient. It was what changed the entire tide for me of parking issues at ski areas. It's like having exterior lots, because it's only a one lane highway from Wilson all the way into the village. Like they just had massive traffic issues, and the bus solved everything, and they did a great job of building this lot and having frequent buses. So I found it incredibly convenient. And so as much as I'm like sitting there and I'm going to stand with workers and trying to live in ski towns and be ski bums and whatnot, I also found that parking in the lot was pretty easy. And I look at it more as the symptom. It's like, it just feels unfair that if you're rich, you can park near the resort. But if you can't afford $35 a day, you have to take the bus. Like, to me, it's just like, make a line. Everyone takes the bus. That's it.
Okay, moving on. Let's talk about drugs and the Olympics, or the enhanced games, I guess we're referring to this one. Basically, I guess it's kind of an Olympic Games where no performance-enhancing drugs are illegal. You were really excited to talk about this one. What do you got here?
Well, so the headline, and this kind of made news everywhere, but I pulled this from The Guardian, says, the enhanced games, a drugs Olympics where cheaters can prosper. Entrepreneur Aaron D'Souza has a plan to host science-enhanced superheroes in an event which encourages doping. So I've definitely heard this thrown out as ideas on podcasts and in articles and all kinds of stuff of just like, what if you just had an Olympics that didn't try to always crack down, and there was this question of doping, and it's just like, hey, no, doping is do whatever you want, and let's get this done. And I think Peter Thiel's behind it, and they have all these reasons of like they really want to like champion the power of science and progress science for long-term health and longevity and whatnot. The problem with that is like we all know that the most like powerful doping drugs there are generally reduce longevity and create a host of issues, like testosterone and steroids definitely are linked to early death. EPO is something that is linked to not only early, but potentially sudden death. I remember back when the Tour de France and Lance Armstrong was riding in it, and his main rival, Marco Pantani, and I feel like that helped lead to his early death. I forget the exact cause. I want to say it was a drug overdose of some sort, but it was also, these guys were so doped out of their minds that, it affects your body and long-term health. So that's the one thing to their main thesis. You're like, Jesus, this is ridiculous. So like, I feel like, first instinct, this is a really dangerous thing. Like you are promoting something for people to take dangerous drugs for very quick short-term results, being like you can get a gold medal at the enhanced games. You just got to be roided out of your minds and jacked up on EPO and every freaking thing out there that I don't even know, and then you can win. And what comes with that feels like a little bit of a circus act in general. I don't know, what was your first kind of thoughts?
That, and just thinking, this is competitive people, competitive athletes will do anything to win. And I'm going to have a different take on this in just a sec here, but those people who want that juice of competing, right? And they love these sports and they want to do them at the absolute highest level. They're making incredible sacrifices anyway. It's like, just add this to the sacrifice list, right? If I take these drugs, I might have a heart attack when I'm 48 because of those drugs, but look what I achieved in my 20s and 30s, et cetera, right? I think you just articulated a lot of that well. Where I think something like the enhanced games or the idea of it is actually pretty attractive is I think we do get really sick and tired of like threading the needle or like where are the lines drawn? Because I think the lines sometimes seem really arbitrary, right? Of like, oh, so that's legal, but I go sort of one step over here metaphorically and this is illegal. Why is that? You know, and I think I understand people who are like, those lines are absolutely arbitrary, maybe not based on the best science, and they're moving targets all the time. And so I get it why people get exhausted by that and are like, let's just open it all up, free for all. Use anything you want and come over here to compete. I just think we're going to have a lot of people dropping dead, young athletes dropping dead, as we frankly used to see with like the WWE, right? We saw a lot of wrestlers from the 80s and 90s, and there a lot of them have dropping dead because of the drugs they were taking. So I think a person, however you feel about this, you know, I think we've kind of all just identified the kind of two camps here. And I don't know. I mean, ultimately, I don't think I would find this. I wouldn't sit there like running home to go watch, you know, a night of the enhanced games. That just, but I sort of understand at least the concept and, that generates the appeal.
Yeah, no, I get it too. And, you know, you just, instead of like trying to cheat the system, you're saying, hey, anything goes, do whatever you want. I don't know what the demand is going to be for this, because if you're an athlete, an elite athlete that is potentially doping, it's not like you're going to switch over to this, because you will immediately ruin every chance at a normal career you will ever have. Like the moment you enlist in the enhanced games, you're never going to the Olympics again. You're never competing in any sort of amateur or professional normal sporting league ever again. So I don't see the demand from the athlete side to truly do this. But I will say there's one thing that I find very interesting. And there was this stat I read recently. It's a fun fact that of the top 30 100 meter dash times of all time, 9 of them have been run by Usain Bolt, which just shows like how incredibly dominant he was. But the other 21 were all done by men that have tested positive for PEDs at some point. And the level of cheating in elite sports is incredibly high, like way more than I think you and I can fathom. There's a really good podcast on Rich Roll's podcast with Kara Goucher, who was the whistleblower against the Oregon Project, the sexual abuse allegations for against Nike and Alberto Salazar, and then also with that doping scandal. And she brings up some of the people. She's kind of thrown some accusations around. I'm not going to name because I've actually forget who it was, but an elite male marathon runner who was very good, but all of a sudden had this like kick out of the blue once he joined the Oregon Project that was just so much faster, and he became one of the more dominant athletes. And she just knows from her knowledge of both having doped and doing it clean, that's not possible without doping. So like the level of doping is really high in a lot of these sports. So I'm curious more in these enhanced games, could you get an elite athlete who dopes themselves up so much that they run a 9.2 second 100 meter dash and destroy Usain Bolt's 9.8 second, you know, world record. And that you're like, okay, Usain Bolt's, you know, like within the realm, probably not doping, but if no one else can touch his times, is they're running 10 seconds. And there's obviously a level of biological gifts and lifelong training that can get to that level. That's not just drugs, but it's also like, hey, the fastest time ever we've ever found in these enhanced games is 9.8 seconds. It casts a lot of doubt on what these world records are actually accomplished through. Were they clean? Were they doped? Were they, you know, just sneaking through the testing with, you know, further advanced science and whatnot? So, I mean, I think you and I have talked about this, but you look at like the four major sports that we watch in America, and the fact there hasn't been, in my opinion, a major star that's been accused of doping, to me is a massive red flag. Because look at football. Some of my favorite players, that isn't natural. Like, you see pictures of them in high school, and then you see pictures of them 4 years later, and you're like, that is not naturally possible. And the fact that we don't have big doping scandals with these four major sports goes more to the leagues, not the players. I look at, like, because doping, when there's millions and millions and millions of dollars online, people will do anything. And as things we've learned through this, you know, the last 30, 40 years of doping, is that doping will always be further advanced than the testing. The testing is always behind. And so it's like, yeah, we had this little run, the baseball steroid era, the cycling steroid era, some sprinters that have been caught over time. But like, it's been suspiciously quiet for about a decade in all major sports. No tennis, no, like, it's just kind of, to me, is a red flag of like, there is stuff going on and leagues are just maybe turning a little bit of a blind eye.
So here's a question for you. Hey, guess what? I'm about to sneak in NFL talk, Cody. A guy you're pretty familiar with, Jimmy Garoppolo.
Yeah.
Right? He just got popped for I don't actually know what.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like not a total star quarterback, not the face of the NFL. So there, and this just happened, right? I mean, this is a very recent story. He's going to miss a few games, I believe.
Two.
Be suspended for a few,
two games.
So like, they're going to bother to pop Jimmy. He's going to miss two games. Who's the last high profile NFL player you can think of?
I can't think of it. You know, it's like DeAndre Hopkins was maybe the biggest one. But
did,
even then,
yeah,
he was on Arizona and it was a little smaller and it was like not as, I don't know. It's like, to me, and this is like conspiracy Cody coming out of being like, yeah, they pop a couple every year, but it's not, they're not popping the defensive player of the year, the, you know, the star running backs, the star wide receivers, the biggest faces. And you're like, you look at like, especially defensive linemen, and you look at them and you're like, that, you don't see people like that. They look like superheroes. And guess what? The people that play superheroes in movies, they're all jacked up on steroids.
That's right.
I saw Henry Cavill in person, the guy who plays Superman. He walks really funny because he's so jacked up that he's like all shoulders out and like swinging his shoulders because his biceps are so big. They like rub against his like armpits and whatnot. And you're just like, yeah, like, I don't know. I'm just, it, this enhanced games, to me, it's like, maybe there's some comparison to the real world that we're going to get out of this, because to me, the amount of doping that's within major elite sports is really, really high.
I just dope on coffee.
Yeah.
That's kind of my, it's treated me well. I still love it. I openly admit it. It's really my only thing.
I'm doping right now, actually. I'm taking steroids, but it's to get rid of a 7-week bronchitis, upper respiratory infection. Had to get prescribed some like inhaler with steroids for the first time because it won't go away. So just making it clear that everyone knows that I'm like openly admitting doping, you know?
Okay.
Because, you know, prednisone is like something that we're all taking to, you know, increase our sport performance.
I can't wait to, I'm going to run and drop the press release. Star of the 50 Project admits on the Blister podcast that he's
using
doping.
Steroids.
Yeah, yeah.
Using steroids.
That, can't wait for that to,
yeah, that'll
can't
be,
wait for that to
make
pop
some
off.
Good headlines. It'll be great.
That's right.
But yeah, so no, it's just like, that's the comparison thing is the only thing I can kind of think of.
All right, well, moving on. You know, I don't think we actually have a Canadian news story this month.
We don't.
We had one from a month ago that was like about a dude who grew a giant ass cucumber. And you kind of vetoed. You didn't like that one for some reason. But one of our listeners sent that in to us. And I don't remember where we got the link. I don't remember much about if he was growing it for a contest. That cucumber was doping for sure. Something was illegal about what was happening there, but
it's doping. It's doping on those like those long sunny summers. You know, like the reason maybe it didn't impress me as much because when you go to Alaska in the summer, that's where all those like gigantic vegetables are grown because all of a sudden it's a short growing season, but you got 22 hours of sun out there. So you know, like I mean, I'm used to giant vegetables already.
Oh, could be. Well, so if anybody is like really sad that we don't have a Canadian news, I think just like do a Google search for Canadian guy giant cucumber. Yeah. Actually, that might lead to maybe don't do that.
Yeah, maybe don't do that.
See what pops up for you there, folks. Okay. That's what we got for Canadian just news.
Don't forget to clear your history.
Yeah, clear your browser for sure. We also don't have a specific mountain town advice question, though I feel like that whole Jackson Hole parking lot story kind of falls a bit about like how one should or should not conduct themselves when being the resident of a small mountain town. But so folks, you know, we definitely don't have a relationship advice one, which I'm sad about. So folks, what are you doing? Hit us up with your mountain town relationship advice questions. And I guess actually Len Nessifer and I will answer those because who the hell knows where Cody will be. But I think that then leads us into what we're reading and or watching.
Yeah, we can get into that. I would say that there was the little bit of feel-good story, which Canadian news always kind of brings up, as and you brought up the Oler spotting, the Oler the dog spotting, which we kind of, the Canadian Avalanche Center. So
first of all, it's Uller.
Uller. I don't know.
Dude, what is wrong with you?
I'm not Scandinavian.
This isn't Canada. This is Colorado.
Oh,
this
I know.
Is like a crested butte
I'm
store.
Saying okay. This takes the place of it of a feel-good story. Okay. But it's not over yet. Okay. And we haven't gotten a full feel-good story. But
yeah. It
was in 2023. There was an avalanche near Marble, Colorado. And unfortunately, killed one person. There was two people that were injured. There was a dog that was lost. And I remember seeing it on social media. People were just trying to like keep your eye out for this dog. Well, almost fast forward almost a year, 11 months later, there was a game camera that caught a picture of Uller. So he's alive and out there. And like people are now reigniting this look, which just like, you know, if there's something like good that comes out of this and it's the fact that this dog survived that avalanche and the fact that he survived for 11 months in the wild or just scrounging or doing something is incredibly impressive. So I just wanted to bring that up for Colorado friends to go check out the links to it and see the photos of Uller and see if you spot him. Bring him home.
Bring him home. Let's get Uller home. What are you reading or watching?
Kind of a couple things. So
I meant to say, when you're not doping,
yeah.
What are you reading and watching?
So I finally did pop culture. I feel like I'm on the pop culture up and up. I have recently watched Barbie. I recently watched Oppenheimer. And I watched Dune 2.
Wow.
Crushing it.
I can't wait. Let's take it from the top. Barbie, what did you think?
I thought it was creative. I thought the opening, the first half of the movie was like quite entertaining and like gave this really, really unique perspective on like, I was like, that was a pretty unique angle to like create this Barbie movie out of. I thought it sort of dragged in the end, didn't necessarily kind of wrap it up super well, but I thought like overall it was an entertaining movie. I was going to give it like a B+ or something like that. Like I thought it was good. Acting was good. It was pretty funny at points. And I just thought it was generally a very creative film, like to essentially like create that story from nothing. I was like, it takes a good writer to craft something like that. Did you watch Barbie?
You know, I started it and I turned it off. Mm. And I feel like there's a bunch of people that are going to be real unhappy, I think, when they hear me say that. And I was, you know, I'd heard a lot about it. I listened to a bunch of podcasts about it. I read about it. I was really prepared to be really in on this. Mm-hmm. And I actually really love it when we have, because we talked about it earlier, kind of our fractured society, right? And I like it when it seems like there is a film or a book that everybody has seen or read. Those moments seem to be kind of fewer and fewer. So I was quite excited to go into this. Like, I don't care about Barbie, but I was like, let's go, let's do this. And I don't know. I either was tired or I should have stuck with it or something, but I found myself turning it off. Probably, I don't know if I made it more than like 15 minutes in. Hmm. And I had read so many like think pieces about this and the rest that I don't know. Should I like go back and actually finish this out?
I mean, according to my review, I would say no necessarily. Like, I thought there's just the setting and the character development in the beginning was really, really on point. I thought it when it came to creating a plot line and through the end of the story was a little bit weaker. But I thought it was entertaining. So if you didn't make it through the first 15, it might not be your cup of tea, which is totally fine.
Okay.
You know, that's like media in general. That's why we do what we do in talking about it, because we're talking about our personal preferences. Oppenheimer, I remember you texted me right after it came out.
Yeah.
You're like, you have to go watch this. And I'm like,
yeah,
Jonathan, I have a child. If I if I'm going out to the movies, it costs me $25 an hour to actually go out to the movies.
Yeah.
And if when I have the time of my day where I do have childcare, I'm not going in the middle of the day to waste 3 hours of my 8 hours of time of not watching my kid on a movie. But it came out on streaming. I was able to break it up in two parts because I'm not going to sit there and watch three hours, but Elise and I watched it. A fucking plus.
Yeah.
Movie was amazing. I thought it was truly brilliant. I thought there's three films in one. There's a biopic, an action pic, and the courtroom drama all in one. I thought they did a really, like, I can't tell you how many times I got chills within that movie when the bomb goes off. That scene was incredible. But then also the final scene, which I'm not going to spoil it because other people are not on this, but the final scene I thought was so incredibly powerful. And it harkened back to a lot of other Christopher Nolan films. You know, the old line from The Dark Knight, which is you either die a hero, you live long enough to become the villain. It has sort of some of those elements to it. So I thought they did a really good job. And some of the critiques I saw of it of like, you know, they ignored the human toll that the atomic bomb has had on Japan and Nagasaki. I was like, no, it 100% did. Like, you have, like, you're viewing it through those guilt of Oppenheimer and guilt of these scientists. And it's like really ephemeral, being like, we changed the world forever. Like, and we caused the death of 110,000 direct people. And we're just scientists that are obsessed with this. And all of a sudden we are involved with war. And I thought it was brilliant. Writing, acting, cinematography, just such a good movie. I definitely want to watch it again.
I saw that shortly after it had come out, and so I'm due for a repeat screening. But I think to capture these absolutely world historical moments in a massively big budget film, great acting, great writing, great cinematography, those are gifts. I mean, I think, you know, I was the lit philosophy major. As much as I love, you know, novels and books, I've always kind of maintained that, you know, the thing about a great film is it encompasses most of the arts, if not all of the arts, into one artistic expression. And so to me, a great film is among the most powerful things out there. And to convey the gravity, the scale, the scope of something like an atomic bomb, I was not feeling inclined to criticize this, but more to just be grateful that we have this and that more people can watch it. Because as we do get distance on these things, right, they can tend to lose their power. And I think this now is a document for people to see for years and years and years, decade after decade after decade to come, and maybe we'll even learn a lesson or two before we repeat some of the mistakes of the past.
Yeah. No, I thought it was brilliant. And then Dune too. Have you watched? I've been on here before talking about Dune 1.
You have. You texted me after Dune, I believe, and you're like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I was a bit surprised because I had not, like, I hadn't read a bunch of stuff about it. And so I'm curious. I mean, I have the little bit I've heard is people are like, Dune 2 is incredible, even maybe better than the first one. That's a little bit of what I got. But what are your thoughts?
I thought in certain ways it was better. In certain ways, it wasn't as good as Dune 1. I think it's also like Dune 1, the first one is just like it was almost a scene setting movie, and it was just so cinematic and so powerful, and it was just bringing, you know, Denis Villeneuve, sorry, butchering his name, the director, brought you into this world that was just unbelievable. And to me, when you were talking about the combination of arts that movie making is, and that was like pinnacle, the cinematography and scenes and the visual and aesthetic appeal of movies. And it was Dune to me. I was just like blown away. I've watched it 3 times. And the third time I had Elise watch it, cause I'm like, Dune 2 is coming out. You have to finally watch this. And I was still blown away. Dune 2 to me, like, you're already introduced to that world, so it takes a little bit of that surprise away. So that's where it can feel at sometimes like, oh, I already like know this world, and it isn't as like, invigorating as the first one. But ultimately they did do an incredible job of just building like scenes. Like there's a scene, and you've probably seen it in the trailer, when the worms are going after people, and it's just like one of the most unbelievable starts to a war sequence you've ever seen. Like it's just like unreal. I would say like acting at times to me was a little not as good as, say, an Oppenheimer. There was definitely more writing in it. The director is renowned for trying to not have much dialogue, and they needed more dialogue in this to move the story along. The first movie took up 1/3 of the book, and the second movie took up 2/3 of the book. So there had to be far more writing within it and far more dialogue. And some of the dialogue scenes I thought were a little weaker, but ultimately I think they get the message and the story of what makes Frank Herbert's Dune so powerful across to people. And you haven't seen it. You haven't read the books either.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So I won't
spoil
it.
What am I even doing with my life?
One, you'll see how much George Lucas just ripped off Star Wars, because holy shit, is Star Wars just a complete ripoff of Dune? But also, I really like the comparison between Star Wars and Dune, because Star Wars is like the Americana hero film, and Dune is like, it's not that. Like, we don't have good, we don't have evil, and they're just like good versus evil. Mm-hmm. Dune is far more complex world, and I really like that because of it.
Well, some of that all sounded pretty smart and stuff, so let me take it down a notch.
Okay.
I watched the remake of Roadhouse.
Oh, yeah. I've been hearing bad stuff.
It's real terrible. Oh, ironically, I've never seen the original Roadhouse.
Yeah, neither have I. Which makes me, I want to go watch the original.
My advice is I really like Jake Gyllenhaal, and probably still like, you know, Donnie Darko, yeah, I'm here for it. This was not good, and it gets stupider the longer it goes. You and I were talking about sort of respective levels of being fried, and so the other night, this is about all my brain could like handle, but I was like, I guess I'll check out this remake, and I don't know why, if you're gonna bother to watch it, like why I didn't go back to the original first, but dude, it was bad, like objectively horrible. And now I'm like, well, if this is based on the original, how much of the original is in this? Because I don't need to go watch or waste 2 hours on the original now, so I don't know.
I've always thought the original is a classic, so I don't know. I should probably go watch the original one day, but good review. Won't have to watch that.
Okay. We haven't talked about any books. Are we both? I mean, you're too busy doping and, and watching 17-hour Dune 2 or however long it is.
I've been a little off the back because I've been so sick at times that sometimes I just like can't even have the energy to read at night. But I'm finishing up Ministry of the Future, and then I'm just about to get done with that. And I still, my review kind of stands from when I was getting into it. Really interesting. Writing can be all over the place at times, but I do really like it. I think it's a worthwhile read if you're interested in climate at all, which most people should because we all live in a climate. So it's in regards to just, I think they bring, he brings an interesting take to the future of climate change and bureaucracies and capitalism, eco-terrorism, all those kinds of things. So stake still stands. I think it's a worthwhile read.
Well, the one thing I've been reading kind of consistently, I've been dabbling, starting a number of things and, you know, seeing what really grabs my attention and interest. But I've been reading The Darkest White.
Oh, by Eric Blem.
By Eric Blem.
I read that.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. I thought I talked about it here, but I read it. I thought it was, I really enjoyed it.
It's so good. Super so good. Far.
Eric's a really good writer. And I, yeah, he tells a really good story, and I really enjoyed the story of Craig Kelly.
The story of Craig Kelly is fantastic. The writing is great. You get the kind of origins of snowboarding as well. So talk about, you're kind of getting, you know, a couple great storylines along the way, and really, really, really enjoying that. And actually, supposed to have already connected with Eric. I want to have a conversation with him about the book. So we still need to make that happen. But yeah, for folks that, anybody who skis or snowboards, doesn't matter which, absolutely check out The Darkest White. And it is a really, really cool history. But you also get introduced to an incredibly cool individual.
Yeah. Such a special human.
Yeah. And I've enjoyed this thoroughly. So don't go watch Roadhouse. Do read The Darkest White. That's what I want to leave you with from this episode of Reviewing the News.
Yep. Otherwise, yeah, I'm with you on that. So,
okay. I think that's a wrap.
Yeah.
So does this mean I don't get to talk to you for 3 months? Yeah. Is this like goodbye?
Yeah, goodbye. See you in 3 months.
Okay. Well, I hope that's not true. There's been some, I've had some talk about trying to get out to Palisades this spring, but if that happens, if you're out till June 1st.
June 21st.
June 21st.
Yeah.
So this would have to be like a Palisades, they're staying open till like 4th of July type
of
thing.
Yeah, we would need a miracle April of massive amount of snow. No, I've already told you, you got to come out. I'll take you into some of the best tree skiing in the world, as I've said.
That's actually what I really want to come out for. But I really do actually want to, like, I've never ridden KT22.
Best chair.
Not one time.
That's so good.
So, okay, well, I'll come out and then you won't be there. And so that's cool.
Perfect.
Not very hospitable of you.
No, gotta go to work.
Okay. On that note, I'll let you get back to work. And but yeah, man, as always, fun to do. And our plan, we'll see if Len is free to come on, you know, because the news still is going to need to be reviewed, whether you're joining us or not. But, you know, I do hope to at least get a text from you being like, I don't think I'll be able to pull it off, but I'm sad I'm not doing it. Could you at least just send that text?
Okay. I'll be on a satellite messenger.
Okay. All right, dude. Well, listen, I hope it is a great spring. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit, but I hope it is a great spring. And till the next time that we record a conversation.
Sounds good, Jonathan. Have a good one.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Blister Podcast. I want to say thanks to Cody for another great conversation, and that I hope he has a great, I don't know, 2 to 3 months. It's probably actually the last time he'll be on Reviewing the News, since I have a hunch that Len Nessefer is probably just going to be the new monthly host of Reviewing the News, you know, for all the reasons Cody said. I still need to talk to Len, so I should probably text Len ASAP, and so he doesn't actually listen to this conversation before he hears that he's being enlisted to replace Cody. I don't know. We'll see. It's a lot going on these days. Anyway, thanks to Cody. Good luck out there, Cody. We'll talk to you soon. I also, of course, want to say thanks to Taylor Ahern for producing this episode. And thanks to all of you for listening. And again, reminder, go ahead and send in to us your Mountain Town advice questions or your relationship questions. You can do that at info@blisterreview.com or go ahead and DM us with those Mountain Town advice questions. That's how we do it around here. All right, everybody, that's what we've got for you here today. Do check out everything we've got going on the website as well as on our YouTube channel. You'll find that at Blister Review on YouTube. And we'll talk to you again real soon. Bye, everybody.